This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. On the day after Christmas, a giant tsunami devastated coastal communities around the Indian Ocean 6 months ago this week. In the days that followed, countries from around the world seemed to compete with each other to pledge funds for relief. Millions of individuals donated too, and this unprecedented rush of aid accelerated as dreadful images of the disaster poured out. We all remember the stories of decimated villages and displaced populations, of civil wars on tenuous hold, and of aid workers struggling to get help to where it was most needed. Half a year later, the picture is mixed. Today on the program, we'll try to update those stories with experts who spent this time working on the disaster. We'll look into what's happened to the displaced, the orphans, the government, and to the environment, which predictors came true, which were averted, what happens next. Later in the program, analysis of the elections in Iran and Lebanon. A winner declares himself in Beirut while Tehran prepares for a runoff. But right now, the tsunami 6 months later. If you have questions about how life has progressed, whether promises have been kept about corruption and red tape or other aspects of reconstruction, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now from Jakarta, Indonesia, is Ellen Nakashima of The Washington Post, and it's good to have you back on the program.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
I know you've been frequently over the past 6 months to the region that's emerged as the center of this tragedy, Aceh, on the northern tip of Sumatra. What does it look like there today along the coastline?
Well, good news is, in Indonesia, the government finally has a reconstruction agency to oversee this long process of rebuilding. The bad news is the agency just started up about 6 weeks ago, and so for many of the survivors in the fishing villages along the coast, the government's presence is not being felt. Actually, in the provincial capital of Banda Aceh, you'll see cars and motorbikes and cafes open. It's bright and bustling. But just a few kilometers away along the coastline, it's still a wasteland with miles and miles of debris that hasn't been cleared. There are tents, makeshift huts and homes and barracks that have gone up. But many people are still in temporary, most people are still in temporary housing and are becoming frustrated with what they see as a slow pace of reconstruction.
Oftentimes when people are frustrated with the slow pace of governmental agencies, they go ahead and do things on their own.
Absolutely. And in this case, in a few villages along the coast that I saw, people have taken advantage of private charitable relief groups coming in to help them rebuild homes using wood, timber from the local forest, which is in abundant supply there. However, this is part of one of the most sensitive ecosystems on Earth. The rainforest in Indonesia is the third largest in the world and disappearing at quite a fast rate. It's alarming to environmentalists. And with about 130,000 houses needed to be built in Aceh, environmentalists are concerned that if people start to use the timber there from the forest, it could accelerate the pace of the deforestation.
Well,
and contribute to, of course, the loss of monkeys and orangutan and Sumatran tigers and elephants.
Yet, as people deal with their frustration, where else are they going to get wood or other building materials from?
Well, that's absolutely right. It's sort of a trade-off, and the local relief workers there are saying, look, these people are living in sweltering tents and crowded hot barracks. They could die of starvation or heat exhaustion. It's better to get them in houses, even if temporary, even if it means cutting down some trees. On the other hand, environmentalists point out that they could be using imported timber or stone and bricks or even, some cases, wood from coconut trees. So the government does have a plan to use timber that's environmentally sensitive, clean, coming from outside. It's just that again, this process of doing it right takes time, and it's slower and more cumbersome. And when you're sitting in a tent without a lot of food and with no family and no job, no home, you're not likely to want to wait.
What about, as you mentioned, a lot of the places that were hit the worst were, of course, fishing villages. Are boats back in the water? Are they being reconstructed?
Slowly, slowly, the boats are being rebuilt. And again, in some cases, with wood from the local forest. But they're not being built fast enough, and not enough of the fishermen are getting back to the sea, which is frustration. And one interesting phenomenon in this tsunami is it happened on a Sunday, which meant men were out at sea fishing or up in the hills farming, and all the women and children were at home because there was no school, and they couldn't swim as well as the men. And so about four times as many women and children were killed as men, meaning all these fishermen survived. Now they're widowers. They have no wives and family, no boat, no job, no house. It's quite a challenge for them.
And I imagine has changed the dynamic between the sexes.
Sure. In fact, one thing I noticed when I was back there about a month ago was this strong desire on the part of the men to get back to a normal life again. And for them, that meant having a wife. In one village I spent some time in, men were living a hut, sleeping on a wooden pallet, like three or four of them side by side, getting used to each other's snores. And, you know, even though they missed their wives dearly, one thing they said they wanted to do was find another wife. And that led to some interesting developments. There was one 65-year-old widower who'd been a fisherman all his life who was courting a 20-something woman from town. And after a couple of dates, not surprisingly, I think she broke it off. He said something about their cultures not mixing, right? But that was just one example. There was another case of a man who proposed to three different women in the same village using the same line.
Yeah, I remember that story you wrote about that. One of them said, hey, why didn't he just use a tape recorder?
Exactly. And the good news is that people are, in some cases, finding love and spouses. And I just happened to be in the village the week that there were three weddings. And the village chief was so gratified, in a sense, to have people getting married again, that he gave some gold to the first couple that got married, sort of an incentive to wed. And to, he said, repopulate the village.
Ellen Nakashima, we'll leave you on that sunnier point. Appreciate your time this evening.
Thank you.
Ellen Nakashima is a Southeast Asia correspondent for The Washington Post. She joined us by phone from her home in Jakarta in Indonesia. Joining us now is Carl Triplehorn, the emergency education specialist for Save the Children. He's just returned to Washington after spending 4 months in Aceh, again, the province of Indonesia, hardest hit by the tsunami. Nice to have you here with us in Studio 3A.
Thank you.
How are the region's children doing? Are they better off or worse off than expected?
Well, from Save the Children's perspective, children are doing better. We feel our response was successful and positions ourselves to actually meeting our mandate of creating lasting change for the lives of children. There's still a lot to be done, but our work in health, our work in education, livelihoods, protection, and construction is positioning ourselves to support the longer-term reconstruction, so we're very pleased with that.
Well, before we get to longer-term, in the immediate aftermath of the tsunami, there was great concern over numbers of orphans.
Mm-hmm.
What happened there?
Generally, the situation of orphans was not as large as we expected. Save the Children was one of the leading agencies in Aceh for the reunification of children, and the numbers were very, very small in considering what could have, what they could have been.
Mm-hmm. So there weren't as many orphans as you feared.
No.
Good. Now, about the reconstruction, I assume that one of the biggest efforts, and not just your organization, but many others, is in terms of reconstructing schools.
Mm-hmm.
What's been going on there?
Well, the reconstruction of schools essentially has been delayed. The government was coming up with a giant master plan that was looking at where clinics were going to be placed, where schools were going to be placed. The issues of school mapping as a population has changed need to be considered. And everyone was waiting for this master plan, and construction was delayed. And even now, very few permanent schools have been built. This has put the international community in a position of building temporary schools in place of permanent schools, which are, you know, probably most of those permanent schools aren't going to be in place for another year and a half, 2 years.
And so, doesn't it irk you to be spending money on temporary schools when they could be moving ahead with the permanent ones?
It does. It's very frustrating, but if we can position the schools in the right place where they are needed by the community, then that is, there's some degree in satisfaction in that. But it is frustrating for us and frustrating for the children who aren't able to be in permanent schools and who are presently sitting in, as was mentioned earlier, in very, very hot tents, in very uncomfortable situations.
There has also, as we all know, been a long-running insurgency in Aceh province. To what degree is any of this tied up in politics involving the conflict?
Save the Children's very, very familiar with that, because we were working in Aceh prior to the tsunami and specifically trying to mitigate some of the impact of the conflict with children there. The politics do play into it. The NGOs are always concerned about whether they're able to have a lasting presence there. But Save the Children feels fairly confident that we are, because we were there before the tsunami.
Stay with us. We're talking about the reconstruction efforts 6 months after the tsunami struck the Indian Ocean area. If you've been there, if you've seen what's happened, give us a call. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, TOTN at npr.org. Back after the break. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today, 6 months after the tsunami struck the Indian Ocean areas, we're talking about what reconstruction, what recovery is underway, what progress needs to be made, what's been holding it up. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Our guest is Carl Triplehorn, Education and Emergency Specialist for Save the Children. And Carl, before the break, we were talking about policies and broad efforts. A lot of this is meeting individuals on a one-to-one basis and seeing what's happened to them. As you were in Aceh four of the last 6 months, what struck you personally?
So many things struck me. Going out to the impact zone is something which is indescribable in words. And when you talk to everybody in Aceh, they are all moved by the experience. They've all had a family member or somebody they know die in the tsunami. And it's beyond words as far as what's happened there, but it also is beyond words as far as how people are beginning to recover and how they're beginning to put their shoulder behind the recovery effort.
And to the children, you must have met extraordinary numbers of extraordinary children.
The children, they all seem to be recovering well, but we run a program called psychosocial support activity, and the children who participate in that activity go through a lot of expressive activities and then learn how to point themselves towards a future, which is very, very positive.
Let's get some callers on the line. Ray is calling from Louisville, Kentucky.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Ray.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to make one comment, ask a question and then make one comment. Do you have any figures on how much of the money that was pledged to these tsunami victims where actually gets to them or gets to their reconstruction phase or whatnot, or how much of it is falls in the hands of corrupt politicians or that type of thing. That's the question I had, and the comment that I had was that I was touched by when they start asking for funds for these victims. I felt very very sympathetic toward them and empathy toward them, but I did not give to it because it seems like it, most of those the money that the people give, it doesn't get to the people that actually need it.
All right, Ray, thank I'm sorry, were you finished?
Yeah, that's about what I wanted to say.
Okay, hang on then. Carl Triplehorn, I'm not sure you can answer for every organization or every country that's donated, but has money been diverted into by corrupt officials?
Not within SAVE. I guess the thing is that Save the Children, $245 million were donated to the SAVE Alliance, which is all of the SAVE partners around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And half of that came from the United States. And so Save the Children is put in a very, very important position curating this money for the people of Indonesia. And we take it very seriously. And so we put special measures into place to make sure that proper accounting procedures put in place, proper program things are put into place, that we are doing the very, very best we can with that money and to make sure that every penny is spent as best as possible.
But do you suspect that some money has been siphoned off by corrupt government officials? Not necessarily Save the Children's money, but somebody's money somewhere?
The government, as was mentioned by Ellen earlier, has put into place the BBR, which is their reconstruction arm, that is specifically meant to address corruption. And they just came online a month ago so that they're able to identify blockages within the system to facilitate people to mm-hmm. be able to work, but also to be able to address the issue of corruption within the Indonesian government. And that department specifically reports to the president, so it's taken very, very seriously.
Ray, I'm sorry?
I hear a lot of comment from your previous remarks about this is delayed and that's delayed and we need time, but it's 6 months and looks like that some infrastructure would have been put in place by now by somebody to make sure that this money goes to these people. I mean, he's talking about the fishermen that don't have a boat and don't have a wife and children and they're beside themselves and they don't have any house to live in. And it looks to me by this time that there's some kind of infrastructure, the Peace Corps or somebody, if the nations are sincere about mm-hmm. the fellow man, that something should have been in place by now.
Ray, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
I just get a comment, Carl?
Yeah, I think just from Indonesia alone, you know, 127 million people were killed, 35,000 were missing, and you're looking at 500,000 people are homeless. That is a daunting task just for Indonesia, let alone the rest of the tsunami-affected countries. So the progress, these needs are being met, but there is still a huge need.
Joining us now from Geneva, Switzerland, is David Nabarro, director of the Crisis Management Team for the World Health Organization. He oversaw prevention and management of health control immediately after the tsunami. And David Nabarro, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you. I hope you can hear me okay.
We're hearing you fine. There were major concerns about possible epidemics right after this tsunami. Those never materialized. Was that good luck or bad predictions?
Well, my own view is it's a combination of very good work and some luck. In other situations, we've seen disease outbreaks following disasters because of inadequate water supply, sanitation, and in some cases, just simple neglect of basic hygiene. Here in this situation, partly because the health services of the countries were pretty well organized before the tsunami, it was not difficult to instruct large numbers of relief personnel to give priority to water, to sanitation, to shelter, and to public health. We did get a small number of outbreaks of hepatitis, of dysentery, and of other diseases, and these outbreaks were rapidly controlled by response teams, and that was very good management.
So among the lessons learned, a quick response.
First first of all, you've got to be quick. Secondly, you've got to make sure that you've got good communication. The best thing for us about the tsunami is we had wall-to-wall media coverage all over the world for at least 2 weeks, and that meant that it was relatively straightforward to get key messages to all those responsible for the response. We've never had that opportunity before, and I've certainly learned the importance of communication coupled with rapid action.
With disease under control now, what are your other concerns?
Well, I really am concerned, as I believe some of your correspondents are, with the need now to get livelihoods back to as many people as possible. I've been involved in reconstruction after a number of major disasters, and normally we expect about 6 months to elapse before all the different bureaucratic processes can get organized to enable substantial reconstruction to start. One of the problems is that many of the people affected in this crisis, as in so many others, were landless people, people without papers, people without property, people who were squatting in various spaces and who were really very, very poor. And enabling those people to benefit from relief is difficult. The voluntary organizations, PVOs, have done a marvelous job, and I've seen many fisher folk get boats and livelihoods returned, and also many rural communities get started again. But there are difficulties with getting proper housing reconstruction in place. My personal target is that we've got to get the majority of people rehoused and health systems and other systems properly in place in 3 months' time. I've seen a lot happen during the last 2 months, but I'd like to see more rapid progress.
In 6 months since the tsunami, would you say in general, obviously the report card is going to be mixed and depending where you go, but in general, a disappointment, a success?
I would say that the cup is half full and half empty. There is a real difficulty in some of the areas because the damage to the infrastructure is so complete. And at the same time, the planning of the re-siting of people's homes and of key facilities has proved to be quite tricky because of real, genuine worries that if there was another tsunami, it'd be terribly unlikely, but if there was another tsunami, we would get further loss of life. So the buffer zone in Sri Lanka and some of the zoning questions in Indonesia have caused a blight on planning. That has really held things up. We've got to make sure that that is overcome quickly. And then ask me the question again in 3 months' time, and I'll give you a definitive answer. At the moment, I am cautiously optimistic, but I just wish that things were really going a little bit quicker in one or two of the worst affected areas.
We'll be back to you in 3 months then. David Nabarro, thanks very much for speaking with us.
And thank you, sir. Goodbye.
David Nabarro is the head of the World Health Organization's crisis management team, and he joined us by phone from Geneva in Switzerland. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Catherine. Catherine's calling from Detroit.
Yes.
Hi, you're on the air, Catherine. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I just recently spent 6 weeks in Galle, which is on the southwest side of Sri Lanka.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that most captivated me while I was there is that the ease with which people talk about the tsunami and have recovered emotionally and as a community pretty effectively. And I was reading in a book by Michael Ondaatje called Anil's Ghost, which is written about Sri Lanka 10 years earlier. And one of the lines the character says in it is that fear is a national disease in Sri Lanka.
Hmm.
And that and struck me that because...
Well, southwest Sri Lanka, that would have been away from certainly the worst parts of the tsunami.
Right. And it's a weird phenomenon, though, that the tsunami, as it was moving west, it hit off the Maldives and bounced back and hit the western side of Sri Lanka. Certainly not like Indonesia, but devastated the west coast in a surprising way.
Hmm.
But just that what struck me was that because people are so accustomed to living in fear, that the tsunami in one way validated those fears, but it sort of enabled them to recover in a surprising way, too.
I wonder, Carl Triplehorn, you were in Aceh, a very different place for 4 months, but the same fear that she was talking about in Sri Lanka?
Well, similar to Sri Lanka, you know, you had the rebel movement there in Aceh, and people were used to living in some sense of fear, but given that this was essentially a once-off disaster, I think that people are viewing it in a different way, but they also were psychologically prepared. And the interesting thing is that the communities are intact. Unlike, say, a conflict where people have to move and are displaced,
mm-hmm.
this a natural disaster like this leaves the communities intact, and so they are able to draw upon each other for support. And so I think that's one of the resilient structures which we're seeing come out of the tsunami.
Catherine, yeah. Thanks. You were there for, did you go just as a tourist or?
No, I was there helping, working on a Habitat for Humanity project.
And how did that go?
It was great. There were, the construction was great. We were working with, mostly with Sri Lankan masons, and so there were conflicts with supply and communication sometimes, but we saw a lot of work done, and that was exciting.
I wondered, was your construction material wood?
No, it was almost strictly cinder blocks and plaster and masonry.
All right, Catherine, thanks very much. We appreciate the phone call.
Thank you.
And Carl Triplehorn, we'd like to thank you for your time today. You. Carl Triplehorn, Education and Emergency Specialist for Save the Children, joined us here in Studio 3A. We're talking about the aftermath of the tsunami 6 months later. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And now we turn to John Waugh of the World Conservation Union. He joins us here in Studio 3A to talk about the long-term environmental impact of the disaster. Nice of you to join us today.
And thank you very much.
There's been some talk about whether or not natural coastlines provided more protection than developed areas. Do we know anything for sure yet? And certainly one of the disasters that people are talking about is the loss of all of those mangrove forests there along the coastlines.
Well, sure. And many of us want to believe very much that places where intact ecosystems existed along this heavily developed area of coastline, that those intact ecosystems did play an important role in protecting the coastline, protecting mm-hmm. people. But we don't know yet. There's been a lot of anecdotal evidence. The reports of damage, aside from places like Aceh that were so close that they were just totally inundated, places further out in Thailand, Sri Lanka, and elsewhere, where the impacts were said to be spotty. And there have been many anecdotal reports that spottiness can be attributed to the presence or absence of coral reefs, mangroves, sand dunes, you name it. But these are anecdotal reports. It'll take some time yet to assemble the information, the assessment information, and try and understand from a geophysical and from a biological perspective what actually happened.
Mm-hmm. And as we heard earlier from Nakashima in Jakarta about talking about the wood bits being logged out of this very sensitive forest area nearby, environmental damage doesn't stop with the tsunami itself.
Well, you could say that there are two tsunamis. There's the water tsunami, and there's the reconstruction tsunami, or some would say the money tsunami. Money brings with it a lot of power, and that power can be used wisely or it can be used unwisely. And and I think it's important not to rush to judgment with regard to how the money can be spent for the long term. The one thing that we don't want to do is set people back up on their feet just to put them right down the road to poverty again. And that's something that there's a real risk of. Countries donating secondhand fishing boats, for example, that have been decommissioned, efforts to try and rebuild fishing fleets can, in the end, do more harm than they can do good. There's a corollary to Murphy's Law that I like to cite called Severide's Law. You may be familiar with Eric Severide, the renowned radio journalist, but Severide's Law goes something to the effect that problems tend to begin their life as solutions. And we need to be very careful here that the short-term solutions don't create long-term problems. And I have to say that in comparing this tsunami response to other natural disasters that have taken place in recent years, Hurricane Mitch, the floods in the Zambezi Basin in Mozambique, and that there seems to be quite a bit of learning going on, and so we actually are much further along in terms of a sophisticated understanding of how all the pieces fit together than we have been in the past. But we're still only part way up that slope of the learning curve. And we need to be very careful that we don't, by deforesting remaining natural forests, for example, in the Sumatra, produce worse environmental hazards and greater challenges to livelihoods than exist already from the tsunami.
John Waugh, stay with us. We're going to wrap up our conversation on the tsunami 6 months later. After we come back from a short break, we'll also talk about elections this past weekend in Lebanon and in Iran. I'm Neil Conan. We'll be back after the break. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Coming up a bit later in the program, we'll check in on elections this weekend in the Middle East, in Iran, and in Lebanon. But first, let's finish up our conversation on the aftermath of the tsunami 6 months later. Our guest now is John Waugh of the World Conservation Union. He's with us here in Studio 3A. And let's see if we get a caller on the line. This is Candace. Candace calling from Quincy in Florida.
Yes.
Go ahead, Candace. You're on the air.
Okay, I had a comment that was in contrast to the previous statements about the waste.
Mm-hmm.
My observation was spending a month working on the coast of Thailand there, up and down the whole affected coast, and particularly in small fishing villages, that people were excruciatingly careful about how the money was spent. And also, I observed immediately following the big groups were the ones that really had the ways and the means to get in there right away with the immediate short-term relief. And then the smaller groups filled in the gaps. And then came the long-term development that, from my impression, the small village we were in, the government had built, of course it was the Thai government, permanent replacement housing for all the houses lost. Small, just adequate, but they were in their permanent houses by the middle of February.
Mm-hmm.
So I just thought that was an interesting contrast. And of course, that was Thailand.
Of course, and different places are responding different ways. Candace, thanks very much for the phone call. Has that been your experience, John Waugh, that different places are responding differently? Of course, it makes perfect sense.
Well, yes, it does make perfect sense. And in addition, I'd like to point out that there's two different kinds of waste. One is in the theft or mismanagement of money. And I think there's a tremendous effort to avoid that, both on the parts of the recipients and on the parts of the donors. Everybody is very, very sensitive about this. And I know that I've been lucky enough to hear the two former presidents, Bush and Clinton, speak on their experiences in rallying support for tsunami relief, and they have been very clear in their interactions with the governments in the region that about the sensitivity to this and the need to take greater care. I think a bigger concern is the waste that happens from poorly thought out emergency response that we can rush in with a lot of solutions that may not be the solutions that the local communities would prefer. They may be solutions that actually are to the detriment of communities. We know that there's a huge amount of controversy. For example, in what happens to the in the resettlement of the coastline in some countries as a result of inequality in both access to government and in the rights to the land, the tenure, untitled or untenured inhabitants may be more easily moved away than very wealthy people, and it may be there's a real danger that the coastline could be ceded in some places to powerful political and economic interests to the expense of the communities, and obviously this could bring some benefits in terms of greater economic development, but it's likely to bring a lot of problems in terms of protracted and intractable inequalities and lack of access to livelihoods. And this is something we're very concerned about, is that that the reconstruction efforts concentrate to some extent on ecological reconstruction and on reconstruction at the community level in order that livelihoods may be restored. And this requires a certain amount of knowledge of what's going to work and what isn't going to work in terms of, for example, fisheries, since that was the example that we touched on before. What fishing pressure can be borne by the resources of that stretch of coastline? And what is their status after being pounded by the tsunami? And what's going to happen in the future?
And I hear that, and I hear David Nabarro of the World Health Organization say, well, last me in 3 months. And I hear, well, they've just set up this agency in Indonesia, and that's going to – and President Clinton was on the program, and we asked him in his role as a special advisor of the UN on this. He says, well, things are going to be happening very soon. It must be enormously frustrating to be sitting in a temporary housing somewhere in Indonesia being told by a lot of very important people that something's going to be happening real soon, and just wait.
Yes, it's not a new story for most of those people. They've been told something's going to be happening real soon most of their lives, I suspect. But yes, it is true that we need to move with all dispatch. Our main interest in this is human well-being. It's not predicated on the notion that people are a problem, and if they weren't there, there wouldn't be any problem. So we want to put the situation back in a way that maximizes the benefit to the communities of the impacted area, and we believe that environmental protection is certainly part of that. But I would just stress the good things that have happened. There have been a lot of mistakes, but there have been a lot of tremendously good things. And frankly, if you accelerated it very much faster than it is now, I think that you would find precisely the kinds of problems with waste and corruption that people are afraid of. So you can't have it both ways. You can inundate the place with money and take your chances, or you can try and do things in a careful and methodical way. Obviously, there needs to break log jams everywhere, and I think everybody's very sensitive about that.
John Wall, thanks very much. We'll be, again, checking in on this story as we pass further milestones. Let's hope there's no reason to update it between those milestones. But we thank you very much for coming in today. John Wall, Program Coordinator for the World Conservation Union, and he joined us here in Studio 3A. When we come back from a short break, the elections in Lebanon.